Chuck, welcome to the program. As Todd said, we've heard a lot about you. We love your organization. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me. I never heard of the VBC, and I'm glad I did, thanks to Billy Terrell. He said, "Gee, you got to talk to this Todd DePristino," so thank you.
Absolutely. You are the CEO of the Library of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. And that's a big organization. We want to get to that very shortly because, like I said, we have a lot to get to with you. But I do want to give everybody sort of that background as to how you got to the point of creating the library. So let's dive back a bit. And we know you're drafty army, but take us back to 69 when you were drafted. What was the feeling like whenever that happened to you?
I actually volunteered for the draft. My brother had just gotten back from Korea, and we were milking the cows. And I said to my dad that I didn't see any point in going to college, and I did it at that point, and I had a curiosity about Vietnam. So he said, "Well, you could sign up for the draft, and they'll take you in order." So we went and we signed up. So I was kind of, the draft pushed me into it, but I was not a reluctant person to go. I was curious. So at any rate, went down, signed up, and got drafted, and actually got sworn in on my 18th birthday in Milwaukee, June 18th, 1969. So, and then it was in Vietnam by December 23rd, or December 8th.
Can you describe to me that curiosity?
Part of it is I've always had a kind of an innate curiosity that, say, my younger brother, he never had that. And I really can't put my finger on it, but it hasn't waned at all. And now I'm 72 and I still have a driving curiosity. I'll go out to California to meet Lately Hayslip, or I see Jill Hunting is on board here. And so part of it is just a natural curiosity, nothing related on a, in a political sense to the wartime.
So was it a curiosity for war or a curiosity for the region, the country?
I wanted to know where it was. I wanted to know what we were fighting about. I cared about politics for a young guy, so it was an amalgam of all of that.
And where were you stationed when you got there?
When we got there, first of all, we flew as opposed to being on a ship. And when we got there, we went to the reception station in Cam Ranh Bay, and then on up to Chu Lai, where the Americal Division was located. And in the Americal, they had three major units. There was the 11th Brigade, the 196th, and the 198th. And out of the luck of the draw, I, along with one other guy, were assigned to the old guard, the 4th of the 3rd Infantry in the 11th Brigade, which was is fortunate now years later, because I'm a life member of the old guard, and that's the unit responsible for guarding the president and guarding the unknown soldier tomb and all of that. So I go to their reunions. And when we landed on San Juan Hill in Vietnam, I didn't know what the big hat was. They had a big cockade, they call it, on top of top guard, and nobody knew what it was. And we little GIs, we'd talk about it, what the hell we're going to defend this thing. And later on, we learned that that was historically significant, dating back to 1784. So that's where I served my time. San Juan Hill, and then working off the hill with small LZs off of this big LZ. So I was in FDC, Fire Direction Center, after spending time as an ammo bearer, and then a gunner in a mortar platoon.
So that tells me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that tells me that you were out on patrols.
Yeah, But generally speaking, I was lucky because after a couple of months, I wound up being an FDC, Fire Direction Center. And so that, and in four deuce, 4.2 inch mortars, and nobody's going to lug one of those things around. So we would be put in on a base, or if we set up a new fire base on a hill, we'd be carried in by choppers. So I didn't face the level of in the bush activity that other platoons in our company did, because I was in the four deuce platoon. So in fact, I think about the one story I like to tell about four deuce and what I was doing was this FDC. And just a couple of days ago, we celebrated the or commemorated the loss of Pat Tillman, who was killed by friendly fire 20 years ago, in 2004. And that reminds me of the luckiest day in my life, which was late at night, 2 in the morning. I was an FDC, and the guy calls in for a fire mission, and we were on a hill, and you had to count off the rings and everything. And anybody in artillery or in the military will know the 6,400 mil circle. And so at 9 o'clock you have 1,600, and then 6 o'clock you got 3,200, and then at 3 o'clock you have 4,800 and 6,400. Well, I inverted a number, and the number was, let's say, one. I called in 1,300 instead of 3,100. That made our firing in a different direction. And the guy started calling in on the radio, "Who the hell is shooting us?" It was really, really something. But fortunately, they were at a different elevation and the rounds fell ahead of them. Nobody was killed. And I thought of that the other day. And to show how that makes a difference in your life, later I was at a bank here in Milwaukee and I deposited some money in an account, and the gal inverted the number. And her boss was standing right behind her, and he started getting on her about, "You can't invert a number." I said, "I got to tell you a little story, because that can happen to anybody, and it could be a lot worse. And she caught it, you caught it. My bank account's going to be okay. We can fix it. Nobody was killed." But in combat, if you're 18 or 19 years old, it can be deadly. So for the guys that were involved with the Pat Tillman tragedy or all the other friendly fire that occurs, I have a soft spot for that. They didn't pull me out of FDC either, so I thought
Going to
they
say,
would,
was there any
but
repercussions from that inversion?
no, I was lucky. I had a staff sergeant. I think he must have liked me, but it was pretty accurate. But even if you're accurate all the time, you can make a mistake, and a mistake in war is deadly, as everybody within earshot of this program knows.
So during that year that you spent in Vietnam, it seems like it was overall a pretty straightforward tour. Your curiosity going into it, was it met? What did you come away with Vietnam understanding about your time in the army, your time in Vietnam?
Not much, which is why I wound up going back. We didn't, because in my particular unit, every experience is definitely different, but we didn't really meet the Vietnamese people or get acquainted with the culture. The special forces, when they train, they get acquainted with the culture and birthrights and funerals and the real nuts and bolts of what living in a village in central Vietnam in the mountains is all about. We just would, to the extent we went into the village, we'd go in and cordon it and do our thing and then move out. Or then later on, I was just firing from a hill. So I didn't know them, and I always thought I would like the people if I got to know them better. And so that curiosity stayed in my mind. Also, I'm sort of something of a history nut, And I was always impressed in American history how America always seems to go back after war and go to work with the people we just fought. And that came from a familiarity with the Revolutionary War. In fact, I got a book here about the Revolutionary War, the Tories and the Patriots, and how we got along after that war, and how the laws were passed that everybody, get together. And after the Civil War, you had Lee and Grant giving the weapons back to Lee's men. World War One, you had Woodrow Wilson with his 14 points. And then World War II, the Marshall Plan. So I thought, well, that would be very American for us to go back. We got a whole history of it. So that's part of what engendered that in me. And the other part was then later in 1984, after coming back and then going to law school, my campaign for Congress in Chicago. And that's where John McCain came out and campaigned for me, as I explained to you. And he said, we got to go back. We always do. And that stuck in my mind. And then later, I met Colonel Roger Donlan. He's the recipient of the first Medal of Honor awarded in the Vietnam War in Nam Dong, Hue Province in 1964. And he went back in 93 and 95. And McCain had gone back to Trac Buc Lake in Hanoi, where he dove into in 85 and 2003. But those two guys kind of planted that seed in me. And then when I came back the first time, we stumbled on the idea of the library. Well, I came back here and I thought I'd talk to a few guys I knew, and let's raise some money for a library.
Okay,
And
so wait, I'll bookmark that because now I think we've flashed over several decades here that I'd like to dissect a little bit.
Sorry.
we'll end the program at 7:25 tonight, people. But Chuck, we want to get spend a little more time with you. So okay, so you come back home after this year in Vietnam. Obviously we've talked about this curiosity, but talking about that experience that you had there, the time that you spent with, the army, the time you spent with maybe some of the people, some of the culture that you were sort of absorbing a bit. You're very young. Where do you take your life after you get back? And Vietnam just kind of sits in the back of your mind?
And when I came back, I was a little bit of a renegade, like I understand a lot of veterans are. I traveled around the country, sold magazines door to door, out in your neck of the woods in the east, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and then I went out west to Colorado and California and Washington and Oregon. And I just percolated for a while. And then I ran across protesters in Oregon, because at that time Wounded Knee was happening. There was a protest up there, and a guy I was working with bought a van and drove up there, and he wound up in the newspapers in Oregon and stuff. And I once again I didn't care for how the not I respected the protest, but I didn't care for the process. So I kind of packed my stuff up and came back to Wisconsin, then started college, and still had that lingering in my mind. And then going to law school had always been something on my mind too, which I did in Chicago and graduated in 79. So, and then after that, I got into politics in Chicago. And
What made you decide to go that route? I'm always very intrigued by this because, at least at that time, like you said, you brought up McCain, as sort of like, how many veterans were sort of going into politics at this time? And, even nowadays, it's evident in my generation, the guys coming back from, the post 9/11 generation, and how few veterans we have that, go into public service. What made you decide to go that route?
I always thought, well, and I don't know if this is true or not, but we kind of let Vietnam, what once we got out of Vietnam, April 30th, 1975, completely, and signing the first armistice in January 73, we just walked away from it, sort of. And I understood the political environment was really sensitive with all of that, but I always felt we should go back for a lot of good reasons. Number one, we're Americans. That's part of American exceptionalism to me. At the end of a war, we put the extended hand from the American enemy is part of our history. But number two, in this particular war, that was even more pronounced because we had walked right away from it. Vietnam was a dirty word in the American political parlance in the late 70s. And McCain, when he ran, and then you had guys like Colonel Donlin, they were still out there talking to people about Vietnam and wouldn't let it quite drop. And as I started to say, I had a couple of guys tell me if I go back, I'm going back with a 30 cal or a machine gun. And there was not a re there was a lot of ill regard for the for the idea of doing anything in Vietnam in 99, but it was because of McCain and Donlin, who I could point to and say, well, these guys are going back. And Colonel Donlin is a Medal of Honor recipient. John McCain is a congressman. And without getting into the political dynamic of it, I could at least point to them as people that had a message we ought to listen to as veterans if we were inclined to go. And that helped with a few people, but for about 10 years, it was rough sledding, let's say, till about 2008, 2009. And then things started to change. And now, the therapeutic effect of time can't be overstated, I don't think. And now, as our generation moves into its twilight years, you see people that would like to go back one time yet. We've got a couple of them. We've got an Skyhawk A4 pilot who's bringing a couple guys over on our 60th trip in December, and we hope more people will come. It kind of closes a chapter, and we've done something for the people, and we've embraced them, and they've embraced us. So that has been the reward in it and the motivation in it, dating back to inspirations like John McCain and Roger Donlin.
So with McCain, did you have communication with him about this, about going back and, as you started to follow him, follow that idea, he actually campaigned
No.
for you. Is that true?
Yeah, he did campaign for me. He came to Milwaukee or Chicago, I should say, a couple of times. And that was a big thing for me because I didn't have any, I was not in politics. I was raised on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. And so running for U.S. Congress in Chicago was a steep enough hill. And he was helpful with that. And he was inspiring at his speech he gave. Recently, I had reason to meet somebody who attended that event back in '84, and they hearkened back to that. So he left a message that people remembered for what it's worth. But he also gave me something to talk about when I talked to fellow veterans later. But I didn't talk to him later. The guy I really hooked up with was Colonel Donlin, and Colonel Donlin at Nam Dong. He was kind of ahead of the curve in military planning. Colonel Donlin had a team A-726 that was involved in the Nam Dong battle, but he also had a guy named Gerald Hickey, who was an anthropologist, with him. And when they assigned an anthropologist to a Green Beret team in 1964, that was kind of ahead of the curve. There was also a guy named Sproul, who was a lieutenant or a captain that back then in 63, who had built that first camp. But What I was impressed with was the idea that they would send an anthropologist to work in the business of understanding the people that they were fighting with. And Colonel Donlan, later, he worked with us when we built the library at Nam Dong and met the old VC and the NVA. And there's a whole story behind that. But Colonel Donlan talked a lot about Gerald Hickey. And I saw him speak maybe 25 times over a 20-year period. And he always mentioned four names. One was Gerald Hickey, who died 2013. And I didn't listen to Donlan's advice. He says, get a hold of Jerry Hickey and sit down with him. And I didn't get it done in time, and he died. And then the three guys that were killed there, and one was the first Australian killed in the Vietnam War, was Kevin Conway, and he was killed in that battle. And then there was another soldier who his wife had twins the night of the battle. One of those twins died and was buried with the dad at Arlington National Cemetery. And then the third one was Gabriel Alamo, and he had been in World War II, Korea, now Vietnam. And so, but Colonel Donlan really took up the idea of going back. It really meant something to him. He went in 93, then he went back in 95. And serendipitously, he went alone. He met this one guide who had been in the South Vietnamese Army, Tran Dinh Song. And after being with Song, there he is. He's up there in 93, and then he's there in 95. He went back because of, you see all the weeds in the first picture. He went and they cleaned up the weeds and everything. And the mountain yards of that community came out with him. And Song, the guy that was his guide, later turned out to be the guide on my first return in 1999. So it when he kept staying with the idea of returning, then later on he went back, and a Australian public broadcasting company did a reunion meeting in 2014. That we went with Colonel Donlan there. At that point, we had the library built there in 2011. We dedicated it. But Colonel Donlan was really an important part in promoting this with other veterans. And it kind of took the I'm going to go back with a machine gun if I go back off the table, so to speak. So we never forget him. And now he's passed away here in January 2025. But so,
How was your bid? How did that end up?
how was the what?
Your bid for Congress or your
Oh, I
campaign?
lost. And everybody jokes about it, and I think it's funny too. And after I started going back to Vietnam, I met a couple of guys. In fact, there was one guy from Pittsburgh, Walker. Bob Walker was a Pennsylvania congressman who was running that same year I was running. And for a few years, I kept in touch with them, even though I had lost. And we had a little group in a training session in Philadelphia. And those guys all joked that if I wouldn't have gone back over there, then there wouldn't be any libraries. And I probably got more done there than I would have in the United States Congress for Vietnam. So, and that was kind of on my mind. So what the hell? I'll leave it like that. Sometimes the fates are better when you lose than when you win.
A good point. Henry had a great question here, and this could be for McCain or Donlan. What was it about them that impressed you the most?
Their willingness. Their willingness to use the bully pulpit that they had earned by their deeds to promote the goal of reconciliation and peace between America and Vietnam. And they never lost sight of that. That was always part of their message. And their deeds followed their words. They weren't just talking about it in the halls of Congress. They were getting on a plane and going over there and meeting with the people that we were shooting at each other with, you know, and that's kind of what our little group does too. You know, we've got chopper pilots with Green Berets and everybody. We all go back and we get involved with it. And that's why we keep going back too, because each of the libraries we build, we go back again later and later and later. We've been back to Nam Dong 26 times now, and we'll be back again this winter. And what they impressed me with is the words and the deeds. So,
You know what I
and
find interesting,
that's a
Chuck, is
lot.
that you know your time over there in Vietnam, you don't seem like you had any sort of hatred for the Vietnamese, for you know the battles that you were in or the conflicts that you got yourself into. You seem to have that curiosity overrode any other feelings that you had as you came back, and that is what continued with you. It's a very interesting thing that I have not heard from a veteran.
Yeah, actually, that I hadn't thought of that way, but actually, it's a good observation. The curiosity never waned, even in spite of, you know, the war. I mean, I have to think about that, Sean.
So,
Interesting.
going up to sort of your first time getting back over there, what led up to this point? Did you already have the idea for the libraries to start, or was it your first time back that sort of necessitated that idea of I need to see what I can do to help out these communities?
You know, the first time I went back, I bought a round the world trip, and I had a visa for Vietnam, but I also bought a visa for China, and I had a visa for Russia, and I was going to go to Malmedy in the Ardennes, and I was interested in massacres and war, and my unit, the 11th Brigade at least, was the first of can't remember first of the 20th and 11th Brigade was the one that was involved with My Lai, so it was kind of an indirect contact with My Lai, and I wanted to get to My Lai. That was number one for me, and number two was to get to meet the People's Committee and the VC that fought where I fought, and that's why when I went over there, I didn't want to travel with other GIs and stuff. No knock on that, only that I didn't want to get preoccupied in conversations with other GIs when my target was to learn about the Vietnamese people and what's been going on since the war. So, in doing that, when we got over there, the idea of libraries was not close in my mind at all. I didn't go over there with a mission. Went over there on a mission to do something, but could have been anything. But when we got into a meeting, it was Song, this Arvin MP, Arvin Air Force MP, who was my guide. Who, when we talked, what happened was I bought two baby water buffalo for the poorest people in that village. And so they thought, then there was a big storm, and there was a story in the South China News when I got on the plane in Hong Kong for the last leg to Vietnam that nobody was going to be allowed in Central Vietnam. So I was afraid I wouldn't even get there. When I did get there, other tourists were stopped. But because I was alone and one GI traveling with a fellow Vietnamese soldier, they let us through, and the People's Committee didn't expect I'd be able to make it. Well, when I got there, because they hadn't ordered these two baby water buffaloes, they had to send to Da Nang, which is at that point about a 5-hour trip. So we got there, we talked, I met, I had a little plaque made up and had it translated actually by a Vietnamese student here in at Marquette University. Given that, we nailed it up. Now, what are we going to do? We got to wait 5 hours for these water buffalo to get there. So, well, I know what we do in America. We get a case of beer when it rains on, and we can't work on the farm. So they went and they got case of beer after case of beer. We all got drunk. But the conversation flowed. My translator was really excellent. He was really tired after that day because and then people started asking about what they did during the war. Where were you? Where were you? And all of that. And then later on, we got talking about what could I do for you? I had the rest of this trip around the world planned, remember? Flying from Saigon to Beijing was the next leg of the trip. And they said, well, this bridge is out here, and we'd heard about this bridge, and it was an important bridge for the local community. I said, well, I don't know about a bridge, because I didn't see how I could do it. But Song said, my country needs libraries. And he had the idea, and I said, that's what we'll do. It'll take us a while to do it, but we'll do it. And then that night, they put together a little lunch and they played a song, and this sticks in my mind too. I call it Auld Lang Syne 69 or 99. Auld Lang Syne, the song, they have karaoke is a big thing in Vietnam, and that's all they had. And this was in a remote, dirty old village, but they had more beer and they put on Auld Lang Syne in Vietnamese. But we tip a cup of kindness then. And that's what the chairman of the People's Committee, this communist guy, put on his first meeting with an American since the end of the war, according to what he said. This was in 99. And that really has stuck with me. In fact, I've got that in a presentation because it showed kind of the place you got to start at if you're going to reconcile and get back together after a war. And he had those feelings, and so did they, and so did all the Vietnamese we met were remarkably warm in greeting us and everything. And I'm sure you've heard that from everybody you talk to, because it's there's something intrinsic in the American and Vietnamese psyche that is simpatico, the. There's an empathy, there's understanding that's unspoken, and it's an amazing thing. It makes the war on reflection that much more sad, because you find out that there really shouldn't have been a reason for the war. I've done a lot of study on it, but that doesn't reflect on the soldiers. That reflects on the politicians, which is another story. But
What would you say out of that first trip was the do you say like what you just recounted, was that the most surprising thing that you found that you learned on that first trip back? That
yeah,
simpatico?
simpatico. Yeah, and that was the, and I saw that being part of a future where I was going to come back more right then, and then a few years or the next year I came back, and of course they had never done a contract with an American on anything, and that was before they had this current licensure body that they have for building buildings and public facilities. So when we were down there working with the People's Committee, again with Song, my guy, and these guys, we spent 5 days drawing a contract. And that contract we still use now. We just started two new libraries in Binh Dinh Province, where the 61st Assault Helicopter Company was located. And those actually are being funded. One is funded by the Vietnam Vets Against the War, which is a little bit apart from politically, but we join in terms of what we'd like to do for the kids and people of Vietnam. So we leave the politics off the table and get our common goals together, which is as much part of what we did over there that we also have to do here, and we do. So I was glad to see the VVAW guys coming through too. So
You get back after that trip. What was the logistics like of trying to, now you had a new mission, but I mean, I wouldn't know the first thing about, hey, I'm going to go build a library in, Zaire. Like,
well, that was also another money raising factor. I was going to have to fund it myself because understandably, there would be a skepticism if you're, first of all, it's a communist government, and at that point, even more communist than it is now. And also the logistics of it, like you say, wire transfers now are easy. You can go to the bank at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 2 o'clock the next morning, they'll have the money in the account, and they can call me. We can talk. But in 1999, you didn't have that, and so it was a bit of a challenge. And watch over overseeing the construction. We hired a guy that I ran into in Hanoi, a Vietnamese guy who was an engineer, and paid him to fly from Hanoi down to Duc Pho, which is down in central Vietnam in Quang Ngai province, and do the oversight on it. This is to make every sure that it's a 4-bag mix, not a 3-bag mix, to make sure that the rods that went into the concrete and the brick was thick enough. Sometimes they try to make those thinner and all sorts of stuff. So monitoring the construction was difficult. And I was glad it was just my money. If it had been somebody else's money, I'd have been worried about that. But I figured, well, I'm going to spend the money and see how it goes. Well, I spent the money, and then they really did a beautiful job. And the contractor, who is now very sick, I'm going to be seeing him for the last time this next trip, if he lasts that long. He did a great job. And the chairman of the People's Committee, the first guy I met, that guy has died too since then. I've been there to see his family since then and all of that. But those two guys did a great job. And that first library in Duc Pho is the reason we were able to do others. If that had been a flop, then I'd have gone back and probably, I'd have come back here and I wouldn't have talked about it to anybody, obviously. But they did a heck of a job, and that's the one that served both in design and the contract that we've used now these 25 years with some small adjustments. But so the logistics of it were a challenge, and fortunately, we had good people on the other end that made it
This,
happen. Really
so I'll bring up a
better to be
picture,
lucky
but
than to be
this wasn't
fun.
the first one, correct?
No, that's the first one in Laos. And that
But
was
is this
funded
the
by Ron
same design
Carmen.
that you've used?
Yeah, it's about the same design, except I made a separate trip over there to talk to an architect because I wanted a Western architectural signature for this. What they do in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia too is, you'll see a school and the school will be rectangular. And it's like a U, and it's very practical and no inspiration in it. And I wanted a separate building. So a kid had to walk out of school and walk to the library, and it would have to have library on it. And it'd have to have a gabled roof, and it had to have handicapped access. And it'd have to have computers once we got that far. This one has all of that, and it's done on a Lao motif with a little bit of Lao architectural signature to it. You can tell that's in either Laos or Cambodia, it could be with the snake on the roof. But so I was involved with the architecture on the very first one because I would not let or wouldn't build it if it was just going to be a square added on the end of an existing building that you couldn't tell was a library. And the word American had to be on it. And working with Americans. So a little something on the we have on the plaque too, on the very first plaque and on every plaque we have that. But yeah, that was the best one we ever built. They did a really great job on that one in Laos, but they did a beautiful job on the ones in Vietnam also. In fact, it's kind of funny. We had 5 days of talking about the contract on the first library, and we got the contract all worked out with this agreement in English and Vietnamese. Now the question was, we had an argument on the construction and the architecture. And I had a Vietnamese guy from Washington, D.C., who had worked with National Geographic on a set that they were just building there, and he came over. And I had a napkin and I drew a little picture on that napkin. I wanted a gabled roof, you know, the things I mentioned, the handicapped access, all of that. He says, okay. Well, we got into that discussion, and they had their communist architect there, and there was the guy who was, sure enough, rectangular building, is going to build it right on the end of that, and he was going to be done. And it only took him about 5 pages for the whole all the drawings, because it was just an extension of the existing building. I said, that just won't work. So the chairman of the People's Committee and I agreed that that Friday morning, their architect and my architect would get together. And I told my guy, don't give in no matter what, and I'll be up in my room. So now it's Friday morning, and I'm up in my room. My guy is down there waiting for their architect to show up. Supposed to be there at 8 o'clock. Guess it'll be about 8:20, and the phone rings, and it's my guy calling from the lobby, and he says, Mr. Chuck, he isn't here yet. We're not going to get it. I said, oh no, no, we just won this negotiation. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, the first thing he's going to come in and say is, I'm sorry I'm late. And that's no position from which to negotiate. The guy did come in, and sure enough, he said, I'm sorry I'm late. And then he turned out he went out and got drunk the night before. And he got up late, and that was the only excuse he had. So he signed off on my guy's plans. And then he asked my guy if he wanted to go out and get drunk with him today, because he had the day off. It was Friday, it was going to be a weekend. And so, again, better to be lucky than to be smart in a lot of things in life. And that was Exhibit A right there. And after that, that was the standard design we would show, you know, with some small variations as we went on with these other libraries.
And I should say that since 99, you've been back to Vietnam. The upcoming will be your 60th trip since 99. That's an incredible story about the first one being built. What was the community's reception of it? And there's a great question here in the chat of this was a communist government. Did they dictate what books could go into this library? Was there any censorship? Lead me through sort of like the finalization. This thing becomes realized, and suddenly this idea that was presented, this new mission you had, is complete. Did you feel like that was the bookend? That was the okay, we did it. I'll see you guys later.
No, that was what I preached from the very beginning. That was only the beginning. When we dedicated that library, that was the beginning, not the end of anything. In fact, years later, parenthetically, the Gates Foundation gave us 10 computers for, I think, 12 libraries we had at that time. And the Gates Foundation is a good foundation, but they got some things they don't do right. One was, they put in these security things to watch the people and all that, but they never went back. And going back is not only important for the relationship, it's important to watch what's going on, and sometimes to do ambush visits. And we did all of that over all these years. That's why we go back so often. Now I've got guys that go over themselves, and I'll send them there, and they'll just go and they'll buy lunch for the People's Committee, and it really gets to be a camaraderie. And so with the book, as for the books, there was and is censorship, but slowly it started unraveling. One example was in Colonel Donlin's library at Nam Dong in Wei Province. And this is in the mountains. The Nung Mountain Yards are the people that live there. We went back one time, and if you go to, I think it's one page in the PowerPoint, I've got a picture of two books in there. I think it's in there. At any rate, the one book, and I go up and I would go to the shelves when I go back, and I go through the books and I take pictures of some of the books. And what do I find in there? This was in 2012 now. I find two books. The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and the biography of Benjamin Franklin. Now, how the hell did that happen? I didn't order it. And there was nobody else who spoke English in that village. And they're in Vietnamese. So I know all of this happened, and I knew things were changing in Saigon and Da Nang and Hanoi, but this is a remote area, and if Colonel Donlin were here, he could tell you. I thought that's just marvelous. That's the Hnungs being the Hnungs. They were kind of an independent spirit, and so later I had lunch with the guy who was the cultural guy, a communist guy there. I says, I got to ask you, what did the war cost you personally? He said, it cost me my ability to be an artist and my love to read. And he took me to his home in Nam Dong and saw all these books. And that's where I found another book about Missouri, the state of Missouri, because we had friends in Kansas City, and that's where Colonel Donlin lived. He had looked that up. He set his mind to work, and they did all of that independently. And there are other examples I have all the way around the country. We have one library right across the river from China in Lao Cai province up north. And that library, when we were going to first build it, I didn't have that. At that point, I had to have a permit. It was about 2003. And so I went to the permit body in Hanoi. I said, I want to go build one in Lao Cai because I met a guy. And the official says, oh, no, you don't need a license in Lao Cai. I said, I don't need a license in Lao Cai. I want something in writing because if I get stopped by the police south of the China border, I'm going to have a problem. He said, no, just go up there. You'll be okay. Well, we go up there and we had dinner and then we had our drinks. And that's when the second meeting takes place, like I told you, all these other meetings. When you get pull out the beer, you pull out the truth. I asked the chairman of the People's Committee, why didn't I need a license in Lao Cai? And there was freedom with books. There was different types of things on the shelves there where we did go. He said, oh, that's 1979 when China invaded. In 1972, Hanoi told us we got to work with China to build this road 200 kilometers into our country. And that comes right across the river at Hekau City there. And we didn't want to let that happen. And they had the power, but we've never been close because of that. He said, and then in 1979, after the Chinese built the river or built the road while they were an ally of Vietnam, well, then they invaded Vietnam. And the Vietnamese captured an armored personnel carrier and they caught some soldiers in it and they didn't have any weapons. And they asked, the one interrogator got a hold of this guy who had all these maps of that road they built 7 years earlier, going from the border 200 kilometers into Vietnam. And along the way, they had planted stashes of weapons for any future invasion and kept the maps of them. And that created this ill feeling between that province and Hanoi. So in that particular case, we didn't need the type of license you needed in other provinces. And there's been variations on stories like that throughout the 25 years. But still up there, that's more remote, back to the books again. That is where they had more freedom with books because they just kind of ignored Hanoi in a lot of ways. And then there was a lady with the Ministry of Justice who was a friend, and she and I worked together, and she wrote a couple books about one was with marital law, how people can sign up for benefits and things in the jungles and in the mountaintops of Lao Cai, and she gave me those books and stuff. So we did a lot of things that were just dancing around the law, and then there were just out and out disagreements within the government that would work to our advantage. I constantly asked the guys in Duck Fo about bringing in books. So at first, I put in three computers. Well, I got down there a couple times, and finally, I always ask about more computers, more computers. No. And then finally, I get down there, and the headmaster greets me, and he says, Mr. Chuck, I got to show you something. And so he takes and rushes me off to this big room. It's got 25 computers in it with kids plunking away at it. This is about 2006. I said, "Where the hell did you get these?" He says, "Well, they had a security in Quang Province donated money for all of them." And I said, "Well, I'd like to get together with him." He said, "No." He specifically says he appreciates what you did, but he doesn't want to meet you because he doesn't want to be associated with the American bringing in the computers. And I understood his the sensitivity of that, and we let go. So we've got this unknown friend who we do know, and we appreciate that kind of thing too, you know. And that kind of thing, there's other stories I can bore you with that too. But it was kind of an insight into the backstories of how Vietnamese government works sometimes. And I gotta say, having been in politics in Chicago, it's not a lot different than some American politics.
So I sort of threw this question in last round, but basically, what was the community's response? It seemed like it was overwhelming for that even that first library that went up.
And it was funny. They had a my guide wanted a picture of me put up there. I says, "I don't care about a picture. All I care about is we get the books, three computers, and we got the architecture we want, always a big thing." He says, "Okay, well." So we kept going back and going back, and this area was always hit with monsoons, and then they had some damage, and we sent them a little money to fix that. And all of a sudden, I went back about 10 years later, and they had this beautiful marble plaque from Marble Mountain on the library that they did without me asking. It's a picture of me, and that's a really it really takes a lot from the aesthetic of the library, but the idea that they thought, and that was 10 years later, you know what I mean? That percolated. Somebody in a meeting sat down and said to somebody else, "Well, we ought to do something." Now the guy's been keep coming back and everything. This is all about coming back. Just a further example of that, you know. And so, in fact, at that same library, I told you we have ambush visits. And ambush visits are, we'll say we're coming through the area, but we don't tell them we're coming ahead. And sometimes you're not supposed to do that and blah, blah, blah. But we came through at about 4:30 one afternoon, and we pulled in to that first library. And I know there was this little old guy who was always walking around the building. I never knew what he did, and I'd see him for 4 or 5 years. I'd seen him. Well, we pulled in there, and the headmaster, an old VC, he says, "Oh, you know, I don't know. We locked the library. The guy locked the library. Go get him. Get him." And he started issuing orders, you know, like you might imagine a communist would, for this little old guy. And finally, little old guy comes running across the yard. Somebody ran and got him, and he comes. He's dangling all these keys. And they started bawling him out. I said, "Wait, wait, 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 wait. Don't bawl him out. Right now, he's the most important guy in this project. It's 4:30 in the afternoon. We got computers in there, and we want him there tomorrow morning. And there's some crooks around here, just like there are in America." He says, "He locked the D. He was doing his job, and I want to thank him." And so we had that exchange. And then we went into the library and talked and stuff. Then we came up, and I'm getting back in the van, and the guy pulls at my shirt like that, and he says something in Vietnamese. And my guy Song says, "This Mr. Hung, he'd like to say he will protect our libraries, our libraries." The way the translation came, and I said, "Was it plural? Like it's ours?" Yeah. The plural was important to me because that showed me he had a little stake in it. That's what his job was. And telling him that he did a good job that one time was a big thing for him, as it should be, because it was from the heart. He was the most important guy. I wasn't the most important guy. I could build libraries all over Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, but if we can't protect them later and and take care of the stuff that goes in them so kids can walk in. We haven't accomplished anything.
The building of the first one, this becomes a much bigger organization, and I'm interested in how that sort of developed. Before we get to that question, there was something put into the chat from Brad. It's a great question, Brad. How do the libraries that you helped to create, how did they differ from the libraries that were already in Vietnam?
Okay, that's a good question because there really weren't libraries in Vietnam except for at major universities in Hanoi, Da Nang, and Saigon. In fact, a VC general took me out into a rice paddy and they would have speaker phones on telephone poles over rice paddies. And one of the challenges we had, as it was explained to me by an NVA soldier, was to get people to go to the libraries because these little reading rooms they had before were always considered blowhorns for Ho Chi Minh. You had either the speaker horns out in the rice paddies when they'd be working, they'd have to listen to this stuff. And if they went in to these little rooms that they had attached to government buildings, a little square room. It would be all the government's message to the people. So the people were so disenchanted with anything from the government, they just kind of ruled it out. The government had literally stymied public education through public media. And the guy that told me that is the guy that the first Vietnamese to appear in America on 60 Minutes. He came over here. He was an English language speaking guy, but he had been an NVA soldier. And he really, his name is Nguyen Nau Hung. And Hung talked about this that when he took me up to a place that's well known in Vietnam, and he took me out on this boat. Now we went out swimming, and then he started talking to me about getting people to read in Vietnam. And I never understood why we went up there for that. It was fun. We spent a weekend up there, but it turned out it's because some of the stuff he was saying was kind of sensitive. He was saying, you want to get people to read, and that you're going to have to go quietly under the radar. And he introduced me to another guy who was the head of a university who was also thinking along those lines. His name was Vang. And these guys were really experts at doing exactly that. So it took a conservative effort by people in Vietnam to work in the information and to change the people's thinking about libraries. And that was pretty fundamental. And there were no, as I say, no libraries in these remote areas. We built one at Khe San in Quang Tri. We built actually more libraries in Quang Tri province and along the DMZ than any other province. And it took some doing over time, but slowly, gracefully, it's being achieved even now, as I said, with the example of the books we found, for example, in the Nam Dong Library. But it's a good question. The people didn't have libraries, basically, in the rural areas, which is where the war was largely fought.
It seems to me that a lot of this story is good deeds sort of beget further good deeds, that people saw the good in what you were trying to accomplish and wanted to be a part of that and somehow support it. And whether that was as an anonymous supporter or someone who, actively was opening the doors, that kind of amazes me.
That's actually another good observation that I hadn't really considered, but one good deed would beget another good one, and they would reciprocate. You know what I mean? So you really wind up working together. The key is not getting too pushy, which is like what I did in Duc Pho with not wanting the plaque put up there in the first place, and 10 years later it shows up. Or not putting the books in Nam Dong, and 10 years later the books show up. and going back and saying hello all the time along the way. That actually has been the most rewarding part of this, is just the everybody's side doing a lot of work. It isn't just Americans dumping stuff off. I will have to say that I'm not impressed with a lot of NGOs, because what they do is they go, they dump something off, they have a nice event, and then they go, and then it shows up on the website, and then they go someplace else. So it really smacks of fundraising at the expense of results, because they don't come back. And like the Gates Foundation, they do a great job at what they do, but then they don't come back. We had a library we built in Laos, 14 kilometers inside the Lao border along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And that library, somebody across the way, finally Gates came in with 40 computers. You know, when I got there, the school guys who we knew whisked me in there to show me that. And there they all were, but they all had plastic over them. I said, "Well, how long have they been here?" "Oh, about a year and a half." And then there were six in the corner that was stacked up. I said, "Well, we tried to use them. We didn't have any expertise. They didn't say." And they, Gates Foundation signed a contract with an IT guy in a city that's about maybe 3 hours away on mountain roads. That guy never came out there, but he was getting the check from Gates all the time. And they had nobody that would go down there and go in there to see if the things are physically working. It was pretty basic stuff. You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You can be a farmer and know that you got to have the tractors in the field. Just have them parked because they don't run in the shed doesn't get you anywhere. And there's a lot of that a lot of foundations do good work and then they drop the ball because they don't go back. They come back with pictures and photo ops, and they have donated. So I'm not challenging that. I am challenging what they do afterwards. They need to rethink a lot of what they're doing, I think. I mean, we're just a small peanut operation. I know that, but that's been a repeated problem we've run across.
Well, peanut operation, but how many libraries have you had built?
We've had 45 built. Now, there's five of them that are not running right now. And of those five, one, we talk about, you know, build something with the communists, and it turns out the Catholics were more of a problem. We had a Catholic parish in Kinzhong province in the Mekong River Delta. Guy built it, and it was really well run for a while and everything, and there's a long story behind it. I went to see the archbishop and complain about this new priest he put in. Now they've leveled that one, and they made an old folks home for priests that are retiring where that library was. So, and we've got another one in Vinh Long in the Mekong Delta where they didn't follow up on it. And then a couple in Laos. In Laos, we had a different problem, and that was the threat that we were trying to develop an anti-government militia in this remote region. And China is building something called the Belt and Road, and it's going right by that village in the mountains in central Laos. And after a time, we had been a there's a long story behind each one of these, but that one is not running now, but it was beautiful. We had it done. We had about 30 Hmong people come over from America who donated money to build it, and we never got it open. So it's not all hearts and flowers. We do have a couple of failures, but most of them have been very successful, but that's a couple that aren't. We have one at My Lai that is really successful. And we had some challenges getting it in politically, but that now that's the best one we go to when teaching English. Every time we go over there, we got people that go down there and teach English. and that's at My Lai. And we always stop at the My Lai Memorial when we go there so that nobody forgets that. So kind of mixing a little bit of the memory of the war, but then looking toward the future. So
Don had a question in the chat. How often are new books sent to the libraries? Do they get books from the New York Times bestselling list?
no, these books, New York Times bestselling list would might be okay for the major universities now in Saigon, Da Nang, Hanoi, but in these remote areas, it'd be like sending them to a grade school or a high school. You know what I mean? But they do, we do get new books there because we buy new books all the time. And when we go again in November, we'll take boxes of books that are funded by people that send us money, you know, and then we take pictures of them with the books. And we also give scholarships out to the kids. You probably saw the scholarships for Nam Dong in the PowerPoint. And we go to each of the kids and each of the libraries and give them scholarships. And so we take books along with scholarships each time we go back. And that's another reason to keep going back.
And I have a let's see here, a couple more questions for you, and I'm going to bring up my screen here because I want to point everybody to your website. So at what point did this then sort of blossom into, the Library of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, the organization?
Yeah, that started with Ross Worley, Sergeant Major in the Special Forces, who I didn't meet in America. I met him in Hanoi the first time in 2002, and I had a couple libraries up at that point. And he, it turns out, has a company in Kansas City, and he attributes as very successful. It's a concrete forming system that he started. Aluminum concrete forming system, and he attributed a lot of his success to some 40 Lao families that worked for him. He said, "Could we build one in Laos?" And I said, "Well, I've never been to Laos, but yeah, I suppose we could." So I sent a fax to some Lao guy I knew at the consulate in Saigon, and he sent it on. And there again, better to be lucky than to be smart. It got to the right guy that took the message and sent it back to me one day later, said, "Come on over." And so that's how we got going there. The other one in Cambodia, there's a guy named Bernie Krischer. He was the Asia bureau chief for Newsweek magazine and the founder of the Cambodia Daily, which was the first English language newspaper in Phnom Penh. And I met him at a restaurant in Chicago one time. We just got talking. And we went to work, and that's how that kind of bloomed. So it was fortuitous and meeting the right people and lucky. So no plan I could lay out. So here's how we're going to do this, and now we're going to go to this country and that country. You just kind of wait for the ripe apple to fall from the tree, I guess, for us.
Was there ever any criticism? As people learned what you were trying to help out there and create libraries, it's such a good deed. I can't imagine there was, but was there any ever criticism about what you were trying to accomplish over there?
Yes. I've flown my guy, I'm calling him, but that's because he is my guy, over to America. And then we went to a series of different places for presentations. And one of them was the Rotary Club in San Francisco. And like all Rotary clubs, they do a lot of good work. And they had something they were had just been involved with in Vietnam, but it was doing water wells, which is obviously a needed thing. So they were doing great work. But this guy got up, or the guy got up, and he said to the after Song spoke, and then I spoke a little bit, and then the president of the Rotary stood up, and this guy from the Rotary Club members got up and says, "Well, I don't see what good any of that does until you give them water." And then he went on rather lengthy, seeing no value in any of what we were doing. And So the president was really a nice guy. He was worried I was getting offended and all that. And it didn't offend me. He raised a good question, actually, you know. And I said, well, let me answer that. And I told him, and I said, you know, there's the quality of life and health, and then there's the quality of life to live. And if you don't make life worth living, then living isn't worth much. And what we do is try to work with, we've got to work together. If you're putting water in there, that's what's needed. Yes, that's the first thing. But it takes a longer vision to get somebody to donate to building a library and educate. And that takes a future orientation. And it's not for everybody because you need everything anyway. It's okay if they want to do that, but they should rule out the nature of other types of giving if you're going to do that in foreign countries. And so we've always kind of looked at it that this takes a long view of history, and you got to believe most of the people what we do when we go there is take a lot of pictures and bring them back and show them to the people that donated this, because they're not going to see a kid graduate from high school. I have a daughter from Da Nang who was in an orphanage, and she was 9 years old when I started sponsoring her. She's 33 now. Now I go back, so I see her all the time. And then she went through college, and now she has a pharmacy in Da Nang. So I saw that. But for most people that donate, they don't get to see the just this fulfillment of seeing a kid getting up there and saying their ABCs in the mountainous region of Vietnam. And so that takes an act of faith to do that and vision for the future. And that's badly needed too. So it's a little different type of giving. Both are needed, you know.
Speaking of giving, can people just go to your website, libraryofvietnam.com, to support your mission?
Yeah, they sure can. And we got a PayPal thing on there, I guess. I'm not the expert that runs it, which you'll be glad to know. But my wife, right? She's not here. But my wife is born in Vietnam, and she is kind of the executive director, and she manages that. And then we have other Vietnamese here in the U.S. that manage the website too, in fact. So yeah, we appreciate anything. The other thing I might say is that if you're thinking about traveling toward the end of the year, we could at least keep you in the loop, even if you just want to know when we're traveling. And
I just pulled up
there you
here. It's December 1st through the
go.
20th
Keep
is when you're
me in the loop traveling. So if you're interested, and even if you decide not to go later, but if you're interested in following the travel, that's where we'll be going. There's the provinces. And so it'll be an important trip just because it's celebrating 25 years. So I see Ken Embers is on here. He's a 61st Assault Helicopter pilot guy. And he and the 61st Assault Helicopter pilot guy has funded a library in Bung San in Binh Dinh province. And that's one of the best operating libraries we have now, in fact. So, and there's Jill Hunting. Jill, tell them about Pete.
All right. Well, I'd like to tell people how I found you, Chuck, and how I wound up traveling with you. And I wrote a book about my brother, Pete Hunting, who was killed in an ambush in 1965. And when Pete was killed, a lot of people contacted my parents and said we would like to do something to honor Pete's memory. And so the decision was taken. And I should say Pete was with International Voluntary Services. And so people contributed money, and my parents were asked, what should we do to honor Pete? And because on both sides of my family, people had founded universities with a gift of books, they decided to build a library in Phan Rang, in Pete's memory. And it was a small library, and that's what they did. Time passed. I read a book by Andrew Carroll about war letters. And Andy talked about this man, Chuck Teusch, who was building libraries in Vietnam. So somehow, Chuck, I found your phone number and contact information. And I wrote to you and said, Chuck, you don't know me, but we have an unusual interest in common, and that is libraries in Vietnam. And so it happened that you and your wife were traveling. I said, come visit me in California. And you did that, and you told me about your trip, and I wound up going on a trip with you. And you made it possible for me to go to Phan Rang and see their new library. The little library built in my brother's memory was gone by then. But Phan Rang has a modern new library because it had this old library. And that was built still during the war. I think it was completed in 1967 by International Voluntary Services volunteers. And when that library was built, the people in this small city didn't know what a library was. And they said, what do you mean we can borrow a book and take it home? And they had to be reassured, yes, you can come and borrow a book. You can come read in this library. So that was a pioneering effort. And so to those of you who are on the call, this is how I managed. I went back to Vietnam for the second time, met Chuck, traveled all around, had some wonderful experiences, and some very, very funny experiences together.
Same translate.
And Song, your translator, was part of that group, and one other person who had funded a library. So if any of you want to consider going on one of Chuck's trips, I'll tell you, you will be in great company. You'll have a wonderful time. You'll learn a lot. You'll love the people you meet. And, it stays with you.
Thank you so much, Jill.
Well,
That's a glowing, glowing review.
she left a little bit out of the story about her brother. She didn't know where he had been killed. And thanks to her and me forgetting my luggage one time, she and Song found the place where her brother was killed, and they said a little prayer from the Book of Common Prayer, and Song said something in the Buddhist observance too. That
That's
was
right.
very touching,
I
Jill.
had a general idea where Pete had been killed in this ambush, and I had the military coordinates from the convoy that came and found his body 5 minutes after he was killed. But we didn't know how close we might have been to the actual site. So there we were in the approximate location, and a man came down and said to our interpreter, "Who is she?" And he said, "She is a sister of someone who died here." And he said, "When I was a little boy, my parents told me never to play here because it was very dangerous." And he pointed down the road and said, "Do you see that sign? I think it said sunglasses." And he said, "Oh, that's where it happened. My parents told me never to go there. That's where they killed the American."
Well, that's
Yeah.
was quite a story to actually find it. I didn't think we had a ghost of a chance, but you had faith, and faith counts for a lot.
Chuck, I want to make sure the website that I can direct people to, I did put the link in libraryofvietnam.com. That is the correct website.
it should be childrenslibraryinternational.org,
My
www.
apologies.
No
Children's.
problem. We may
Yeah, I
have
didn't want to send people to the wrong place. Is it? It's Children's Library.
international.org. It's painfully long.
I hear you about, yeah, we have veteransbreakfastclub.org, which always, when you type it out, takes a little bit of time. I will put that in the chat now. But I want to thank everybody so much for joining us tonight, especially you, Chuck, with this just incredible story and this incredible message. It gives me hope to know your story, to know that there are people out there doing these good deeds, like we said, and hopefully this tonight will help beget even more good deeds. It's been a pleasure, everybody.
Keep going,
Thank you all. But Elvis has left the building. You guys all have a great night. Hope to see you all tomorrow morning.
a
Chuck,
lot.
everyone, Jill, thank you so much. And please, you're welcome back anytime. Thank you all again. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching this episode of the Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was one two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco Free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.